there is an incentive problem as a result of the two-party system that has been manufactured by the parties. Our policymakers, our elected officials are incentivized to put partisanship and loyalty to their party above loyalty to their constituents.
Welcome to the Independent Riot Podcast, your home for free thinkers, independent believers, and radicals questioning the status quo. Our goal is to provide you entertaining, intelligent discussion around all of life's most pressing questions without hidden agendas or ulterior motives. So if you're too good for the bad, too bad for the good, and sick of people trying to convince you to join their preferred pyramid scheme this week, you've found your home. Now here's your host, Jim Duncan.
Holy hell, America. If you haven't completely drunk the red or blue Kool-Aid yet, where do you even turn for answers? On the one side, we've got shirtless, fur Viking hat-wearing shamans storming the Capitol over crazed lizard alien cannibal conspiracies. And on the other, you've got the elite woke police drooling eagerly over the idea of controlling your every thought and word to make sure at no point you step out of line and turn dangerously impolite or insensitive. And through it all, the mainstream media has basically become propaganda divisions of either that red or blue team to make more and more money off of fueling your anger and suspicion of your fellow American. Yet in actuality, no matter which side wins, the rich are just going to keep getting richer and you're going to keep getting played. If you're desperate for unbiased, nonpartisan information to try and form your own game plan for figuring out how to interpret what's best and real in American politics without becoming a goose-stepping member of either the red or blue cult, where can you turn? Obviously, subscribing to this podcast would help because that's what we're all about. But also, we have an even more specific answer for you in today's guest. Sean Griffith studied history and philosophy at the University of North Texas, is an election reform expert, and now the national editor of the Independent Voter News. Over the past decade, IVN has dedicated itself to fighting the good fight and providing unfiltered political news and policy analysis from across the political spectrum, covering political ideas and information without taking a stake in its outcome. From their website, IVN explains the news currently being presented by traditional media outlets only alienates independent-minded voters by presenting only right-wing and or left-wing perspectives to truly complex, multifaceted political issues. The Foundation for Independent Voter Education created IVN to be a new kind of news network. IVN provides unfiltered political news and policy analysis across the political spectrum. And overall, they're working to strengthen independent-minded engagement with politics through information, education, and resources that are unfiltered with partisan bias, which makes them a perfect match for this channel. And luckily, Sean Griffiths is an extremely knowledgeable guy that's going to be able to not only explain more in depth what IVN is doing, but then also even break down some kind of complex political reform ideas for you, such as open primaries, ranked choice voting, and we even get into an interesting discussion about what the duopoly is itself. So if you like independent thinking and you're ready to start winning arguments with your drunk uncle without having to side with either the far left extremist or the far right extremist, give this episode a listen. You're going to get a lot of great information, and please stick around to the end where I'm going to come back on and give you my big takeaways from the conversation. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast and maybe throw us a good ranking on whatever podcast player you're listening to it on, as well as maybe check out in the show notes. There's a couple of other ways, like signing up for our Patreon, that you can become an even more active supporter of independent thinking content. And now, without further ado, Sean Griffiths.
The independent Independent Voter News has been around for 10 years. It initially started, as you said, the Foundation for Independent Voter Education is one of its co-publishers. Another co-publisher is the Independent Voter Project. And when you look at our archives, there are some articles that predate 2010, but it really got started in 2010 as a platform to educate California voters on the Proposition 14 measure that was on the ballot that year that was written by the Independent Voter Project and implemented the nonpartisan top two primary there. And it was an opportunity to present a balanced perspective on the amendment so that voters could better understand it when they go to the polls. And so IVN actually published more anti-Prop 14 articles that year than pro articles, as a way to give voters that kind of balanced perspective on the initiative itself. After Prop 14 was approved by voters in 2010, it expanded to be, as you said, an open platform for independent-minded voters who might feel marginalized by the mainstream conversation. And so it was then, and to the best of my knowledge, continues to be the only news platform geared toward independent-minded voters that's founded on an etiquette rather than an ideology, a four-point etiquette. No partisan attacks, no personal attacks. Our authors have to substantiate their claims, and there's no self-promotion on the website. And that has been successful for us, and it's really resonated with our viewers. And we've grown to 500,000 followers online. We've reached out to millions of people over the years. And I would say, you know, one of our biggest success stories is how we have been able to educate voters in very simple terms about the need for broad systemic electoral reform that goes beyond just primary reform as it started, but covers the broad spectrum of the many reforms that are needed to fix the political process.
Yeah, and so one thing I would maybe emphasize, if this is correct, so you guys started out of California, but now you're definitely taking a more national approach as opposed to I've seen a lot of your content still can focus somewhat on California, but you're trying to provide solutions that anyone can use across the country, correct?
Right. So, like I said, one of our co-publishers is the Independent Voter Project, and they focus a lot of their reform efforts in California. And IVN itself has a San Diego a page for more localized reform and other news for the San Diego area. That's where the Independent Voter Project is based, and IVN is based, is in San Diego, California. But on the reform, particularly in the reform space and even in other news areas, we do have a broader national focus on our national page for efforts across the country.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for someone, because this channel tries to break some of these bigger concepts down for people that might not pay attention to politics on a regular daily basis. And so some of these things can get pretty abstract and complex to get your head around if you only tune in every once in a while. Mm-hmm. So I might try to start this discussion with a big picture question of why does the two-party system, Republicans and Democrats, suck? What's the main thing going wrong with it?
Well, you know, and I ahead of this, I was thinking of all the ways that I could answer this question, because it's a topic that you could really devote hours to.
Oh yeah.
And books, there are multiple books on this subject. Yeah. But I think in the short time we have, in very simple terms, at the foundation of the problem, I mean, most voters look at what's going on in our nation's politics, and they recognize that it doesn't serve their interests.
Yeah.
Really. And at the core, it's a lot of people look at it and they'll say that the system is broken. But really, the system is working the way it was designed to.
Yeah,
we have a political system that over decades has been manufactured to primarily serve the interest of the Republican and Democratic parties. Yeah. And at the core of any problem that you think that exists within our political system, whether it's hyperpartisanship, whether it's too much money in politics, whether it's gerrymandering, whether whatever problem you see, at its core stems from the fact that our electoral and political system is now an industry that is controlled by a two-party duopoly to serve their interest above the public interest, which one would, that serving the public interest is what one would expect from a representative form of government, but that's simply not what we have today.
Yep. And I think that is one of the big things that sort of crystallized my thinking on this was, which I'm sure you're aware of, Catherine Gale and mm-hmm. Michael Porter's study in 2017 on the politics industry, and basically assessing politics from a business analysis standpoint. And it basically came up with the exact same conclusion that you're saying, that it's actually working properly, only to simplify it, the voters aren't the customers.
Right.
The
right.
corporate interests and the political parties themselves are the customers. Mm-hmm. And one point that I would bring up for any viewers or listeners is, which it shocks me that a lot of people don't realize this or haven't thought about it in these terms, that the Republicans and Democrats, because we've always had it that way, we assume they're like, it's a legitimate part of our government to be Republicans and Democrats, like it's somehow sanctioned in the Constitution. But there's nothing, these are private organizations that are sort of there. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we need Republicans and Democrats, and there's nothing holding these private institutions to a certain behavior. Mm-hmm. So outside of the individuals being elected to office. So that's fascinating to me, that lots of times people just think it has to be a two-party mm-hmm. system with the Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Catherine Gale and Michael Porter's work, because I was going to mention it as well, because it has helped me kind of reshape the way that I talk about this in more simple terms. Because as you said, so talking with Catherine and Michael, their work was initially designed to help the business community better understand the need for broad systemic reform. And so they put it in industry terms. They put the politics industry, as they call it, in industry terms to help them. But it has helped really the average American better understand the problem too.
Yeah.
Because when you look at it as an industry, you can make very important analogies and allegories to what our system is very much like. So our system today is akin to if you wanted to go out to eat for dinner and you only had two restaurants to choose from.
Yeah.
And you may not like the two restaurants, that you might think that they don't have the consumer's interest at heart, and you might disagree with their business practices, but there are no other restaurants that you can go to, because on top of being the dominant restaurant chains in this industry, they also control all the rules and regulations of that industry itself. So they are allowed to keep competition from emerging. And so in those very simple terms, you can understand the problem with our current political industry, and that, to your point, they are private organizations. And it's important to note that when we talk about reform, it's not an anti-party message. The fact that the Republican and Democratic parties exist is not a problem. The problem is that they have exclusive control over how we elect our public officials and the entire political process itself, and have rigged the rules essentially to their benefit exclusively rather than the voters' benefit.
And that's in that restaurant analogy, again, because, yeah, people seem to like people are basically educated to know that a monopoly is bad, but somehow they don't understand that a duopoly, if the two sides are working together, is the same thing as a monopoly. I mean, there's a little bit more competition, but for the most part, it's not true competition. And like in that restaurant analogy, even if, and this is something that at times I've struggled to get people to understand, but so you have those two restaurants that you don't like your choices there and how they're performing, and they're regulating themselves, which means there's no regulation. If you opened up competition where there were five other restaurants, you might never even have to eat at those five other restaurants, but the competition itself is going to make those two main restaurants up their game and be more responsive to the customer.
Well, and that, you know, and when you read Catherine Gale and Michael Porter's work, they explain, again, in industry terms, that's how a free market industry should work, is that if you have a monopoly or a duopoly, or if you have an industry that's predominantly controlled or is dominated by a company or maybe two companies, if they don't serve the interest of their consumers, a competitor can still emerge to take their business away from them in most industries. The problem in our politics industry is that's impossible because of the regulations and rules that the parties have been allowed to put in place. From the very beginning of the electoral process, you can start off with the primaries. You have partisan primary systems that from the beginning force people to choose from two sides. The narrative is always on the Republican Democratic Party and their contest between each other and this very us versus them political narrative that has allowed the media to treat our politics as a spectator sport.
Yep.
And then you have, I mean, again, any real issue that you have with our, like, that gerrymandering is a problem. The parties control how our electoral districts are drawn, so they can split up communities so that people aren't properly represented. The political parties, if you think money in politics is a problem, the political parties control the largest flow of money in our political industry. A lot of people don't think about that, because in the mainstream conversation on, say, money in politics, you hear a lot about, say, super PACs and independent expenditures and all the money they spend on campaign ads. And certainly that's something that can be addressed. But something that isn't discussed is that there are limitations on pretty much all political giving that anyone can give, except for the political parties. Yep. And in fact, when you look at FEC regulations, the organizations that are allowed to receive the highest amount of donations from any group are the political parties. And they have an unlimited flow of money between the national parties and the campaigns. So that money can constantly interchange and flow without limit. Yep. So really any issue you see with our politics today at its core stems from the control that these two private organizations have over the entire process.
And then that makes me think, like, I'm trying to think from sort of devil's advocate of some of the arguments or questions that I've had people ask me when I'm arguing against the two-party system. And one of the myths, I would say, is the concept people will say, well, if a third party was good enough, they would win. Maybe that's a good place to start with. Why is that not true? And even you'll hear some libertarians or Green Party members think, like, they don't get that the math is stacked against them, the money is stacked against them. All of those things make it a near mathematical impossibility that a third party is going to win the presidency and or get any sort of foothold in Congress to make a difference.
Well, right. So in certain areas of the country, you'll see third parties and independent candidates be more successful at a local level, but local politics is often not as partisan and divided as national politics.
Yeah.
So in certain areas of the country, you'll see in more local areas them have more success. But you're right, in terms of Congress and the Senate and the presidency, it is impossible for third party and independent candidates even to get their voices heard in the current system. And so because of the decades of kind of conditioning people to see this as a two-party system, which to your point, there's nothing in the Constitution that says it needs to be a two-party system or that it needs to be a party-centric system. The system we have today was manufactured to be that way. But over the decades, because we've been conditioned to see, you know, politics as Republican versus Democrat, it may be a long time before we see a third party or independent candidate emerge, even with the reforms that are out there, that can be truly competitive and could win, say, the presidency. But why nonpartisan reform is taking off so much right now is because it at least allows these candidates that to get their voice in there. And yeah. When you can get your voice in the process, then all of a sudden two major parties have to address those ideas, the new ideas that are in the system.
Well, that's the analogy with the restaurants again. That's right. A third restaurant popping up, which maybe doesn't take all their business, but they raise right. The health concerns or whatever that those two parties now have to respond to.
Mm-hmm. And so when you look at things like primary reform or, a very popular reform that's really taking off across the country and gaining a lot of momentum right now is changing how we vote for our public officials through ranked choice voting
yep.
in terms of ranking candidates in order of preference instead of just choosing a single candidate. And in a place like Maine, which was the first state to pass it at a state level, in this past Senate election, the independent candidates were invited to most of the debates, and that is unheard of in much of the country.
Yeah.
That you would have independents be invited to share the same debate stage as the major party candidates. You certainly don't see that in presidential debates, where the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates has made it impossible, essentially, for third parties to really get onto that debate stage, have really stacked a deck against them on yeah. that. And that's because under ranked choice voting, there was the possibility that neither Susan Collins or Sarah Gideon could have gotten a majority of first preference votes. So yep. then the voters, the people who voted for those independent candidates, they become a lot more important. So the ideas of those candidates become a lot more important, and something that that the major party candidates have to address. So we're already seeing the impact that nonpartisan reform can have on our politics.
Now, and I definitely think, like, if I had to put the most impactful reforms for people to care about, ranked choice voting is probably at the top of the list for me, I would think. But I know, and I'm going to challenge you with this. Can you succinctly explain to somebody that doesn't pay attention to politics much what ranked choice voting is compared to what we have now? Like, right. So they understand it.
Right. So the current system in much of the country is a choose one voting method in which you go to the polls and you select candidate A, candidate B, whichever is your choice. However, under the current system, third-party independent candidates don't have really much of a voice. So people are conditioned to believe that they really only have two options, and that's Republican or Democrat. And if they should vote for a third party or independent candidate, the common thing they hear in the media and on the campaign trail and from the political pundits is that they risk the candidate they least want getting elected.
Yeah, the wasted vote argument.
The wasted vote, the lesser of two evils voting that we have. And so that causes voters to think more strategically rather than voting for their conscience or for the person they truly prefer. They're voting strategically, like this is a game of chess that they have to figure out how to maneuver the pieces in order to get the result they least want. Under ranked choice voting, instead of just bubbling in or selecting on an electronic string a single candidate, you can rank candidates in order of preference and how you prefer those candidates. So if you prefer a independent candidate or a third party candidate, you could put them as your first choice. And then from there, you can select which major party candidate is your second choice or your third choice. And the way that it works is that on the initial tallying of votes, they take the first preference of votes. And if no candidate gets the majority, an automatic system of runoffs is held. So it saves the county, the elections administrators time and money, and it saves voters from having to go to an additional election.
And that's a good point. So the voters they only actually cast their ballot once. They only vote once.
In the more technical term, it's called single transferable vote. So you're only voting once. But it's an opportunity to have an election and potentially a runoff in the same election without having to have another election that will most likely have a lower turnout. And so that race would end up being decided when not the most voters participate. And so from there, if an additional round of runoff is needed, the last place candidate is eliminated and their voters' second choices are applied to the result. And that system continues until a candidate has a majority, and it ensures a majority. Now, ranked choice voting has a documented history of making voters feel more confident in their vote. Polls and various ranked choice voting elections show that they're very satisfied with the system, that they feel more confident in their choices, that they can indicate which candidate they truly prefer, but also still feel empowered that, since they know, if they should be an independent or third party voter, that their voter or that their candidate most likely won't win, that they still feel empowered to have a say in who of the major party candidates is going to win. But it also leads to, and this is very important for people who believe that division and hyperpartisanship is a big problem in our politics, which most people would agree with, that it leads to a more civil campaign environment, because all of a sudden, candidates aren't just campaigning for a voter's first choice. They're campaigning for their second or their third choice. And if you're campaigning for a voter's second or third or fourth choice, you're not going to be digging on their first choice. You're not going to be saying negative things about their first choice. So the logical conclusion of that is that it just leads to a more civil campaign environment, which I think benefits all involved.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And it, so maybe an example, and correct me if I'm missing anything with this example, but, in the past election, so we had Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, which lots of people put social pressure on each other against the wasted vote theory that you got to choose the lesser of two evils there. But if we had had, for instance, ranked choice voting, and say you were a big environmentalist, so you wanted to vote for Jill Stein or someone that to give green concerns your vote, even if you know she's not going to win in ranked choice voting, then both, if there's a substantial minority of people that are planning on voting for her, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden would have to focus on courting those voters to some extent. Is that a good way of looking at it? So
correct. And, we had quite a few states this year where neither Joe Biden or Donald Trump got a majority of the vote. One of them got a plurality, obviously, but not, they didn't cross the 50% threshold.
Yeah.
And a common argument after, I mean, basically any presidential election in modern history is the third party spoiler. You know, the one side was spoiled because this third party or this independent candidate was in the race. That argument essentially goes out the window if you have ranked choice voting. You can't make that argument that, oh, this third party candidate spoiled the election for me under a ranked choice system, especially when it ensures a majority winner. Because if there isn't a majority winner from first preference votes, then it goes into that automatic runoff where the least popular candidate is eliminated, and then their second choices are allocated until one of those major party candidates gets a majority. And that's just the reality. One of those major party candidates is going to get the majority. It all depends on who has the broadest appeal among the voters that didn't choose them as their initial choice.
Yep.
So yeah, it does force them to have a broader appeal and to address the concerns and the ideas of voters who might not otherwise vote or who might not prefer them, but under a single choice might feel compelled to vote for them.
And I've heard some party loyalists try to discourage or fight against ranked choice voting with by arguing that it's too complex for the average person to get. And it's just, which is pretty absurd. And it's just literally as easy as saying, I like this person best, this person second best, this person third best.
And I've had conversations with ranked choice voting advocates and other reform advocates on this point. And that is a reason why they're been more successful in their messaging lately in terms of educating voters is because they don't get into the tabulation explanations, because that can get a bit complex. Like how the state tabulates votes can be a bit more complex, but it is when all that's required of voters is to rank their choices, first choice, second choice, third choice. It's that simple. And when you break it down in that way, voters better understand it. And when you explain to them the benefits, voters better understand it as a better method for choosing candidates.
Yep. And now if, in addition to ranked choice voting, what would you say are your top other reform concepts that would help to break up this duopoly, or if break up is too strong a terms, but improve the function of our political system? What else would help if people understood?
I think a very critical reform is primary reform. We have to have a system that treats voters and candidates equally, that levels the playing field. Because in a lot of cases, there are millions of Americans who are denied an opportunity to vote in the primaries simply because of their choice in party affiliation or lack thereof. Party affiliation is a condition to an equal and meaningful say in the elections process, because in a majority, an overwhelming majority of cases, you know, and when you look at Congress, for instance, 85 to 90% of congressional seats every election are considered safe for one party or the other. Yep. That means the most critical stage of the election process is the primary, because ultimately the dominant political party in that district is going to win. So it all comes down to who wins the primary among those party candidates. So it's important that we include and give voters confidence that they have an equal and meaningful say in the process, all voters, regardless of party affiliation. And when you open up the process, and I would say nonpartisan reformers are largely getting behind the idea of nonpartisan primaries, like I was saying, where everyone is on a single ballot, all voters and candidates participate on a single ballot. You're also broadening the electoral base that these candidates have to appeal to.
Yep.
Particularly in districts that are heavily Republican or heavily Democrat, because, you know, gerrymandering reform is also important, But even under independent redistricting and citizen-led redistricting, there are going to be districts that are going to just be heavily Republican or heavily Democrat.
Yep, this is sure.
How, yeah, that's just how. But this forces these candidates, these party candidates, to clarify what makes them different and how they can best more broadly appeal to the broader electorate. And then when you combine it with something like ranked choice voting, which we saw in Alaska this year, voters approved the first top four nonpartisan primary, in which the top four vote getters in a primary election, regardless of party, move on to the general election. And then ranked choice voting is used in the general election to ensure a majority winner so that you're not getting a simple plurality winner, a situation where somebody could win the election with 30% of the vote, which would mean that 70% of voters didn't vote for that person. Yeah. That doesn't sound very democratic. So then the ranked choice voting system ensures that they have majority support. So I would say that primary reform is very important. We are seeing momentum behind that. Amendment 3 in Florida got 57% of the vote.
And still didn't pass, though.
Still didn't pass because the legislatures are continuing to raise the bar on amendment. It seems like the legislature in Florida is very opposed to voters meddling in legislative affairs and policy affairs. So even after the amendment to restore voting rights to felons passed, members of the legislature tried to raise the bar again from 60% to I think 70 or some odd percent of the vote there. After that, I mean, fortunately that failed because that would have made it even more, even harder for reform to pass. But you saw in St. Louis, nonpartisan primaries pass in that city, and they combined it with what's called approval voting. And approval voting essentially allows voters to choose as many candidates as they want. I mean, it's that simple. And the candidate with the most votes wins. So I would say primary reform is critical. I would say changing how we cast a ballot and that voting method is critical. Reforming the gerrymandering process to ensure that districts are more representative of communities rather than breaking up communities in order to ensure a dominant party's majority and to strengthen that majority is important. I mean, honestly, the list goes on. There's no single solution to fix the myriad of problems with our political system. But what I'm optimistic about is that we are seeing these coalitions of reform groups emerge, coalitions like the National Association of Nonpartisan Reformers, which is an organization that is composed of pretty much all the major election reform groups in the country. And they may all individually have different objectives in terms of whether it's anti-corruption reform or whether it's ranked choice voting reform or whether it's primary reform, but they are starting to collaborate and find common ground and combine these efforts in a more comprehensive way, like what we saw in Alaska, to provide a more comprehensive, better approach to the way that we conduct elections so that they are fairer and more accountable to voters, that they're voter-centric rather than party-centric.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point to that you don't have to, if you're trying to make things better as an individual, you don't have to understand all of the ins and outs of all of these issues and potential solutions, because that can get overwhelming. When I started getting interested in this, I thought I was going to figure it out in, you know, a long weekend. And then it took me literally two or three years of reading about things and paying attention to sort of get my brain up to speed on some of these concepts and where the different fights were at on them. So that would maybe be, ranked choice voting is something that people could definitely get behind and should put their time into understanding and fighting for, as well as open primaries, which the open primary versus closed party primary. One way I've tried to, again, emphasize this to people is that, so you think it makes sense initially that the Republicans have a primary and they should get to choose their candidate. But then with gerrymandering, if you're not a Republican, you really don't get to, there's really no place that you, as not being a Republican in a heavily gerrymandered district, get a chance to be represented, because the extreme of the party is picking their candidate and they're a 90% lock to win that election.
Right. So
if you're not on board with that, you're completely out. And an example I've used before is to explain, like, okay, well, again, the Republicans or Democrats are private institutions. So what if you just imagine changing that name from Republican Party to Frank? So Frank, some guy named Frank gets to pick the, have his primary with his friends that pick the candidate. And then the district is already drawn where Frank is going to win once he picks his candidate. So are you on board with that? Most people probably aren't.
Well, you're right. And then Andrew Yang in a recent podcast quoted a Boss Tweed, who said, you can vote for whoever you want for as long as I can do the nominating, right? That's that's essentially the attitude of the parties. As long as we can do the nomination, you can vote for whoever you want. Just, you know, your choice is what we tell you is your choice. But, you know, one of my first comprehensive articles on IVN was looking at the Senate or the voter turnout for the U.S. Senate race in Texas back in 2012, which was the first election that Ted Cruz won his seat for office. And what we found was because it's not just on the congressional level, but like a state like Texas back in 2012 was very safe for Republicans. You know, the Democrats, when you talk to people who are very active in state politics, even Democrats admitted that their candidate was more the sacrificial lamb in November elections. So now you have to pay attention more closely to the primary elections between, at that time, it was David Dewhurst, who was the lieutenant governor at the time, who actually won the primary or got the most votes in the initial primary. But because Ted Cruz was able to get enough votes, he was able to force a runoff. And it was a July runoff, a summer runoff, where basically you take the primary turnout, which is already low, and you cut it in half.
Wow.
And so at the end of the day, Ted Cruz won that runoff with less than 4% of the entire registered electorate in Texas.
Wow.
So if you put in that terms, Ted Cruz was guaranteed a victory with just 4% of the vote.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. And the problem is like also the way that people have been sort of convinced to think only in two-party terms, binary red versus blue terms. You'll hear lots of Republicans that are probably like, yeah, ha-ha, that was great. That worked perfectly. The system works.
Right.
Except when it flips and it works the other way. Then all of a sudden you realize that, oh, wait a second, maybe the system doesn't work.
Right. It's really baffling to me to see that in one state, a party can support a particular reform, in another state they won't. Because it's all about, for the parties, it's all about who benefits. Again, and when you look at any type of reform, it for the parties themselves, just like the entire system is, and the entire narrative behind the system is geared toward, it's who benefits.
Yeah.
And so they'll oppose ranked choice voting, or Republicans will oppose ranked choice voting in Maine because they feel like it won't benefit them. It will benefit Democrats more than them.
Yeah.
And so they'll get their members behind opposing it. But then in Utah, when you have the state party that uses ranked choice voting in their state convention to choose their party officers and their candidates for November, They use it and they say, wow, this system works. It's a great system. Yeah. It makes even our members feel like feel more confident in their choices. It's an interesting dynamic to see where parties support reform and where they don't, and how they flip-flop on it based on who benefits. And then in battleground states like Florida, both major parties will oppose reforms like nonpartisan primaries. And that was one thing that Amendment 3, which was the amendment to implement a nonpartisan open primary for Florida state and legislative elections, was adamantly opposed by the two major parties, because that is a state where either side could benefit depending on how turnout is. So yeah. It's always baffling, and you get a laugh out of it. It's kind of a sad laugh, because that's one of the biggest barriers to reform right now, is the powers that be that are adamantly opposed to it, that are putting a lot of money, a lot of effort to oppose any type of change that could challenge their control over the process. However, the reform space is making tremendous gains. It made huge gains in 2018 in particular, and then again made gains this year, and continues to build on that momentum for future elections. So if you're concerned about the way that politics is today and how our electoral system works, you know, there's reasons to feel optimistic. Even when you look at it at a realistic approach, there's still a lot of work to do. Because only half the states in the country allow voter-driven ballot initiatives.
Okay.
So if you want reform to pass in the other half of the states, you have to go to the legislature, and that's a tough hill to climb. But you know, I know that the people within the reform space are working hard in states like that to get, you know, legislators behind some of these efforts.
And that's one thing that I would point out of why it's important, if you're listening and you care about improving the system, then it actually is fairly important to at least sign up for, become aware of, somehow start reading like independent voter news or getting on a newsletter. There's other groups like Represent Us and different things, but to somehow, because every state, it gets really complex, because not only have you got national issues going on, but then you've got state and local issues, but right. Every state can be somewhat different in its way that it's conducts elections or what its current issue is. Mm-hmm. So it's important to sort of latch on to groups like you guys, so you can help break down the bigger concepts as well as coordinate and get those people in the individual states together on their respective issues.
Right. I would say, yeah, because I mean, the more people that get involved, the more pressure there is on policymakers to make the reform that people need or the people want. I mean, you have seen that with every major social movement in our country. It's when the people get adamantly behind that movement that puts the pressure on policymakers to finally act, because there's only so much of an extent that lawmakers can get away with not listening to people, especially when you have a huge amount of people and that get behind something. But yeah, I would recommend people check out our content on IVN. We have a lot of articles that break down these reforms in very simple terms. Get involved with organizations like Represent Us or Fair Vote or the Center for Elections. I mean, there's a lot of organizations. And if you're right, it does get a bit complex, because the way that it works is that every state, every county, every city can essentially decide its own electoral process. So the electoral process in my state can be different from the electoral process in your state. And that can complicate things. But at the same time, The way that I like to phrase it is that this just expands the opportunity for different types of reform to emerge, and so that reformers can see what works and what doesn't work. You have hundreds of individual laboratories of democracy in this country, thousands even, that can be used to experiment. If you read about ranked choice voting and you're not entirely on board with it, and you think and you read more about something, another voting method like approval voting or another method, and that sounds more appealing to you, you can get involved with a campaign to push for that. And then in your local government, seek to have it implemented. And then so you can have ranked choice voting in, say, New York City, where it was passed last year, and it will be used for the first time next year. And you can have approval voting in St. Louis, and people can see which methods are working best for voters. And what works for voters in New York may not work for voters in St. Louis. So for me, that just expands the opportunities for the reform space to make gains and to see what works specifically for voters, because again, it's about empowering voters, making it fair, making the system fair and accountable to voters. Because right now, if there's one thing that people need to take away from this, is that there is an incentive problem as a result of the two-party system that has been manufactured by the parties. Our policymakers, our elected officials are incentivized to put partisanship and loyalty to their party above loyalty to their constituents.
Yep.
And the idea is to shift that incentive structure to put the interests and needs of voters first. And that is the goal of nonpartisan reform.
Yep. Yep. That sounds like an excellent point to end on. And is there anything else? But your guys' website is ivn.us, right?
Correct. Our website is ivn.us. You can find us on Twitter. The handle is IVN. And I believe our Facebook is still Independent Voter. So yeah, you can find us on Facebook. We have a lot of people who get engaged on our Facebook page. Find us there as well. And check us out, check out our content. Like I said, I've devoted the last 8 years, more than 8 years that I've been in this space, to covering this reform space and to educate people. And I feel like the one thing that I'm most proud of is that we've been able to successfully educate, millions of people at this point on these reforms and need for these reforms. And the more educated people are, the more they'll see what's wrong with the system, and the more they'll want to get involved.
Yep. And then as people get educated and see it, like, it becomes so blatant, you can't unsee it at a certain point.
Right.
Like, things that have got to improve. And the great thing is they can improve, because nothing is written in stone. So we can improve the system to work better for voters. So thank you very much, Sean. This was an incredible knowledge drop, and appreciate you coming on and sharing your wisdom with us.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
And there we go, everybody. Some terrific insight from Sean Griffiths, the national editor of the Independent Voter News, on some things we can all start doing and understanding in order to help diminish crazy red versus blue political polarization while fighting for higher political standards and a better functioning democracy for everyone. The key is, there's got to be a better way than red cult or blue cult, as in, you should be able to believe in free speech and individual liberty without having to also brainwash yourself into thinking that an amoral, narcissistic real estate mogul is somehow Christ's anointed savior of the American people from a lizard alien cannibal enslavement conspiracy. Or that maybe equality, science, and keeping people healthy are all worthy goals, and they don't require us giving up all of our privacy and civil liberties to a self-appointed class of hypocritical ruling elites in order to get there. I would suggest if there's one main takeaway from this conversation with Sean, it's to try to reframe your thinking from being a participant in the red versus blue game to being its referee. If we can make the American system work the way it was envisioned, it will actually work for everyone, regardless of who wins. And we're never going to make democracy truly functional if everyone is always so freaked out that the one side is good and the other evil that you won't let yourself see the bullshit inherent in all politicians. And believe me, those in power on both sides are much happier to keep you fighting against your neighbor rather than really asking what in the hell they're accomplishing or holding them to actual standards of performance and anti-corruption. I realize it's a lot to get your head around, though, so don't feel overwhelmed. Just listening to someone like Sean Griffiths explain some of these concepts to you is a big step in the right direction, and I'd highly recommend you go on to IVN.us to sign up for their newsletter, as well as to check out a lot of great articles they've got explaining reform concepts in more detail. Sean's also just started his own podcast called Toppling the Duopoly, which I definitely encourage you check out. And last but not least, consider helping provide us, the Independent Riot, with some additional fuel to knock down the ridiculous red versus blue doomsday machine as well. You can easily help us out by subscribing to this podcast and maybe telling a friend about it. Or if you'd like to make even more of an impact in promoting independent thinking, consider becoming a monthly supporter or sending us a one-time tip of a couple of bucks, just like if you bought a beer or a coffee. All of the relevant and important links are in the show notes below, including to our YouTube channel where we have some shorter videos explaining concepts like what the hell the duopoly is. So feel free and please do check out all those things. And in the end, though, no matter what you do or where you are, keep thinking for yourself, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Independent Riot Podcast, your home for free thinkers, independent believers, and radicals questioning the status quo. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please do us a huge favor and leave a quick positive review on whatever platform you're using. It's free to you and super easy to leave us a good ranking and really help spread the word about the podcast to other independent thinking folks. Thanks for listening, and please go ahead and subscribe so we can be sure to see you next time.